Hello, I'm David Mousecrop. Welcome to Open to Debate. Artificial intelligence means different things to different people. As an amorphous set of technologies deployed in countless applications, AI is a tricky thing to understand, regulate, and integrate into our social and economic lives. This is especially true when conversations about it, even among experts, may be premised on misunderstandings or multiple understandings of the thing itself. And yet AI, broadly understood, is already shaping how we do business, how and whether we employ people, how we communicate, and plenty more. In short, it's kind of a big deal, and we need to sort out how we wish for it to fit into our society and our lives. So what is AI, and is Canada ready for it? My guest on this episode of Open to Debate is Murad Hammadi, a journalist with The Logic and the co-author of Superintelligence: Is Canada Ready for AI? Let's start with some definitions because, you know, in the aftermath of the AI arrival and explosion, particularly generative AI, there's been a lot of mainstream attention, a lot of mainstream interest, but perhaps a little less mainstream understanding. So let's start here. What are we talking about when we talk about AI? What does that mean in practice?
Yeah, so this, it's funny because people in the industry will often say something along the lines of, you know, AI, ML, however you want to define it. It's like, well, I would like you to define it, please, because that's helpful. So AI is not a sort of specific technology. It's kind of it's both a sort of continuum and a set of things, right? So AI has been with us for quite a long time in some shape or form. Often it's things like back-end automation. Google search is a good example of this. There's not like a little human on the back end typing out the responses to your Google search.
Wait, what?
They're automatically generated. Yeah, I know. It's wild. There's an entire state just dedicated to this stuff. But like it's automated, right? There's a degree of automation. And we've come to sort of expect automation in various areas of our lives. If you, for example, if you order a ride share, the matching between yourself and the driver is automated. It used to be you called into a taxi, you know, office and someone did it for you, but this is now all automated. So those are forms of AI. You know, what people talk about as algorithms, you often hear about it, sort of ordinary people often hear about it through things like the Spotify algorithm, right? That's choosing what to play next. Those are all forms of AI. The stuff that's really getting the most attention these days is the generative AI stuff. So ChatGPT is the reference most people would be familiar with. And those are systems that use a couple of key sort of forms of the technology. One is neural nets. And this is really the Canadian way, if you will. It isn't solely Canadian. It wasn't just invented in Canada, but a lot of foundational work was done here. Neural nets are a way of building AI models or AI systems that sort of works like the way we think the human brain works. So rather than saying, you know, the old form of AI is like, essentially, it's kind of like a giant phone tree. It's a bunch of if-then statements, right? If you do this, the system will do that. And then you program all of those in, and then it kind of goes down the phone tree. What neural nets have done and the way you train them is more like, say you've got a picture, a folder with a bunch of pictures of animals in it, and you want to sort the like dogs from the cats. The old school way of doing that is you teach the system, here's what a dog looks like, here's what a dog's ear looks like, here's what a dog's paw looks like, and then here's what a cat's paw looks like, and here's how you know, and that's why these are different. The neural net method is you give it the folders and you let it figure it out. And over time, it sort of comes to, and I try to be careful when I'm talking about AI, not to use words like understanding or thinking, because, you know, these are ultimately, at least right now, still program systems. They're not thinking or understanding for themselves, but it develops a system for figuring out which is which. That's neural networks. The other bit is something called transformers, which is to say, when you or I read a sentence, we typically take into account the words around the word we're reading at any given point in time, and the words that came earlier in the paragraph.
And maybe later on, you'll read a word that makes the word that you read before make more sense, right? It's context. And transformers are a way of getting AI models to understand context. You put neural nets of transformers together and you get ChatGPT. It's a little more complicated than that, but that's the high level.
That's pretty good. That's a lot of stuff in a single answer. That's a great start. Because, I mean, there is so much. And I think what's interesting about this whole conversation is that there are so many elements to this category of technology. There are so many potential applications. There are so many current applications that, as you mentioned at the start, like we don't, even TechX folks don't necessarily specify at the top what they're talking about. So the rest of us are sort of saying, what are we doing? Including government, I think, and I want to get to government in a second. But first I want to talk about the book. You know, in Superintelligence, you write about generative AI, and you write about a generative AI summer that the world is basking in today. And that has a Canadian connection. We're going to do the Canada angle trademark right now. what is the generative AI summer? And what does it mean for us in practical terms and uses in Canada?
So November 2022 is sort of the start of this process. And it does actually, it kicks in most in the summer of 2023. No one would confuse November for a Canadian summer. So November 2022, OpenAI, which is a San Francisco-based startup, releases the product ChatGPT. And what that leads to is essentially a lot of speculation, hype, building castles in the air about what this technology can do, because most people's experience probably of generative AI for the first time was this, essentially this interface where you could ask it a question and it gave you an answer that seemed like something you might have in a conversation. Now, that answer could be depending on what you asked it and the state of the model, that could be a conversation you were having with a particularly ill-informed person or someone who was pretty well-read. And so the applications we're starting to see, but I'll give you a couple of examples. There's a company based out of Canada called Spellbook that does sort of generative AI for lawyers writing contracts. So rather than copying and pasting clauses out of a bunch of Word documents, you tell the system, like, this is the kind of contract I'm working on, and it generates a first draft, right? And that speeds up the work of the lawyer. Or you have, there's a company called Augmenta in Toronto that does, like, behind the walls of an apartment or, like, any building, there's a bunch of, like, wiring and piping and, like, conduits for stuff. And this company makes technology that basically draws you a first draft of that that's code compliant. Those are like practical applications of the technology that are starting to be used by businesses out in the world. And so people might encounter them at that kind of technology at their jobs. But most of what we're seeing is like LinkedIn and X and Facebook flooded with posts by people, like long posts where at the end someone is like, and you won't believe this, but all of that was written by ChatGPT. And then you go back and you're like, no, I believe that. There's like no human rights in this way. There's been a lot of like sales and marketing people talking about how generative AI is going to change everything. And like people who want to be thought leaders writing about the transformation of society. And like some of that stuff's happening, but not all of it yet.
Yeah, it really is a big moment for grifters, isn't it? I mean, when isn't it? But it seems like AI is just a grifter's dream.
Yeah, and I think this is a distinction that I'm really trying to make in my reporting, is like, what is actual AI advancement? Advancement of the technology itself, let's say. And what is, you know, basically a thin interface on top of someone else's technology? And that is actually an important distinction. Like there is undoubtedly a lot of legit work happening to make the technology more powerful at the things that it does. And I'm being careful with that distinction because there are obviously, let's call it mixed opinions about
how like capital G good this stuff is for the world. But if you take it on its own terms, there are companies and researchers who are doing things with this technology that simply weren't possible 3 months ago, 6 months ago, you know, certainly 10 years ago. And a lot of them are putting it to applications that they believe are, you know, legitimately useful around things like sustainability and healthcare and so on. But then yes, there are lots of people, like there's a AI for every crypto entrepreneur in the last cycle, there's an AI entrepreneur who, or an AI company that's selling you something that like no human would ever have any use for.
Yeah. Except for students who want to try to cheat. It's funny, because we all, you know, encounter AI in ways in which we're aware differently, right? Depending on what you do. There's, as you mentioned earlier, there's a bunch of background AI happening. But as someone who's taught some courses, that was the first time I really had to really think carefully about AI, because in putting this course together, an expectation I had to think about how students might use AI to game. I heard of this thing on the internet where an instructor was putting in some white hidden text into the syllabus, into the instructions for the assignment, that would instruct the ChatGPT to insert something into the piece without the student knowing, so they could catch cheaters. This is the great cat and mouse game that has emerged in academia. Truly a wonder.
Yeah. I think there's an interesting, like, and this actually captures one of the tensions of this stuff really well, right? Like, it is certainly true that there are lots of people, like, writing is the only thing I can do, pretty much. It's legit, like, my only skill. Sometimes I talk people good. But there's certainly lots of people who have like a sophisticated understanding of the subjects they study who might not be able to put the words in the right order. And so there's like assistive qualities to this technology that enable people who have other skills to do parts of their jobs that are annoying or that just aren't suited to their skills. There's a meaningful distinction, I think, between like feeding an AI writing model all of your thinking and getting it to put out a set of words that captures that thinking better than you might be able to, you know, in your own writing ability, and saying, you know, use ChatGPT's database, which is like basically scraping large parts of the internet, often not quite up to date, you know, a few months or years out, initially a couple of years, and then now a few months out of date. And ChatGPT does the research, quote unquote, and the writing, as opposed to just the writing. And like, that's a thing, that's the attention we're going to start to see play out, I think, more and more.
Yeah, and it's so fascinating because, I mean, you're always going to have people who abuse technologies, and drawing those lines is going to be an exercise in ethical, social, legal distinctions that, well, sometimes we're not the best at, but I look forward to the evolution and pivot a little bit in the meantime to come back to the Canada angle trademark. You know, in the book, you point out that Canada has had global tech leads before and lost them. Nortel, BlackBerry. You even mentioned that BlackBerry had a chance to jump on the AI bandwagon early and didn't take it. Does Canada have an AI edge now? And if so, will we keep it? Or do we expect that there's going to be pressures for flight to the United States, to Silicon Valley, that will undermine any AI advantage we're able to manage?
Yeah, so maybe let me start with what our AI advantage certainly was, and then we can get to what it may or may not be today. So I was talking about neural nets before, and there was a period in the, certainly in the 2000s, when neural nets were very much out of favor in the AI community. It's called the neural net winter. And essentially, people didn't think that way of doing AI could work. And there were a few places where that kind of work continued. And Canada happened to have two of the most significant ones. In Montreal, around the University of Montreal, and a lab run by a professor named Joshua Bengio, and a lab in Toronto at the University of Toronto run by a professor named Jeff Hinton. And they both individually, but also perhaps as importantly, a group of their students made a bunch of the breakthroughs that proved that you could actually use neural nets in ways that kept up with and then beat conventional AI systems. So in a sense, you wouldn't have a lot of what you have today, certainly in the generative AI space, without the breakthroughs that were made either literally in Canadian labs in sort of the late 2000s, early 2010s, like through the decade of the 2010s, and or with some of those people working with collaborators elsewhere. So what we had was essentially a brain trust. The two sort of unifying, longstanding fears of Canadian technology are brain drain and company drain, you know, losing talented people who go to particularly the US to work for large technology companies, and then losing the companies themselves when either they're bought up or they fail eventually. Nortel being an example of that kind of failure, and then, you know, the parts of it being scattered to the winds. The early phase of Canadian AI, you know, Jeff Hinton went to work for Google. A lot of his students went to work for Google or DeepMind, which was eventually acquired by Google, the same in Montreal. What you then had was a generation of companies that tried to build domestically the likes of Element AI and Maluba, which were eventually sold to large Silicon Valley firms. Today, there is quite a significant ecosystem of companies. The most prominent one is a company called Cohere out of Toronto, and they make the kinds of models, the same kinds of models as OpenAI makes, the ones that power ChatGPT, except they make them for businesses. And Cohere is an interesting case study to answer the question that you actually asked, and I'm sorry, I like to answer the ones that weren't asked as well.
You'd make a good politician.
that is an insult of the highest caliber. Cohere is a good example of this because their founders are Canadian. The company is based in Toronto because their founders are Canadian, and they wanted to build in Canada, but also because, you know, the kind of talent you need to build these models is in relatively significant supply in Toronto relative to some other places in the world. And also, frankly, it's cheaper than what you'd pay in Silicon Valley, although the gap is closing. But they also have an office in London. And in fact, one of their key research people is based in the UK. They have an office in San Francisco. They have now an office in New York. It used to be the case, sort of like certainly 20 years ago in Canadian tech, that the opening of your San Francisco office was the first step in moving across the border, because your investors eventually would say, you know, come on, it's time. All the money is here, all the people are here, why aren't you here? It is possible now to build a tech company from Canada, and it certainly seems to this point like Cohere is planning to do that. So some of the factors have changed, and we have a sort of critical mass of people and companies at this point. Whether we have an advantage, I think, is one of those time will tell things.
So it wouldn't be fair then to say that Canada has been slow on the AI uptake, right? I mean, it seems like, in fact, contrary to traditional narratives about the country, we've been fairly quick. But I mean, I think sometimes critics of the country, critics of one government or another, forget that just how much pressure there is coming from the United States, right? Particularly as it sees AI as a kind of countermeasure for geopolitical reasons. You know, they've got to get ahead of China, they've got to get ahead of India, maintain hegemony, that sort of thing. I mean, do you find that on the AI entrepreneur side, that the tech community has a commitment to the country that transcends business, that transcends economics? Or is this ultimately really just a question of dollars and cents and where they can grow and scale the company the most?
Certainly no one is selling to a primarily Canadian customer base, right? And that has been the way for Canadian tech companies for a long time. In fact, you know, adoption is an interesting thing. Canadian businesses as a class are really, really bad at adopting new technology. Bad at sort of a pan-advanced economy level. And there's been some early signs that AI is not necessarily that different. There was some survey work out of a think tank at TMU that suggested we're behind other advanced economies on this. So, you know, they're not Canadian startups that make AI products are not being held here because their customer bases are here. They're being held here because of, as you say, an affinity for the country, a desire to live here. And frankly, by the availability of skilled workers who can build the stuff that they're selling. I don't think, but you can run a company from sort of anywhere these days, right? You could have a Canadian entity that's a subsidiary of a Silicon Valley firm and keep those great workers, but re-domicile yourself in the States. What's keeping them here is a few different things. There are tax incentives. The SR&ED tax incentive is quite attractive. Now, there's a whole thing just in kind of the last little while, depending on when this goes out, with the budget and the capital gains credit, and a lot of people, a lot of founders quite upset about the changes to the capital gains inclusion rate, and, you know, certainly threatening that companies will leave in the same way that people threaten they'll leave the U.S. every 4 years. Whether that happens, you know, I have some doubts, and we'll obviously see. But do people feel an affinity to Canada? There's a certain thing about being a Canadian startup, for sure. But, you know, a Canadian founder in the States can be just as successful as they can in Canada. There's no sort of like fundamental factor holding them here.
And so let's build off of that and talk about the government more specifically, because, you know, some people think or would have you believe that AI, like any tech, is a mere product of the private market and it ought to be left as such, you know, perhaps with some help from academia. With AI, it was interesting because we did see tech leaders around the world, and particularly in the United States, come out and raise some concerns about AI and suggest an AI pause. We've seen governments mulling what to do about this. So that's all by way of saying governments are a part of AI, whether we like it or not, like they are with any technology. You know, so let's start with Canada. Does Canada have, one, an AI strategy, and two, a plan for an AI regulatory regime?
Yes and yes. So there's a thing that's formally called the Pan-Canadian AI Strategy, which is a program that was set up in 2017. The initial version of the program basically funded, subsidized universities to hire and retain academics. It's since expanded to commercialization, which is basically turning new discoveries and ideas into products and companies. And now there's a bunch of money in the most recent budget for compute, which is like the cloud and AI infrastructure, the processing power and the hardware, like the data centers you need to run this stuff and train it. So we do have a strategy. There are all kinds of questions about whether, you know, in the first instance, funding academic research was the right call. Certainly, those academics have trained a lot of people, and the country has brought in quite a few very accomplished people. The compute stuff, how you actually pay that out, you know, does it end up going to foreign cloud companies like Amazon and Microsoft and Google, basically just to buy time on their servers? Or do we do something more strategic, build data centers here that are Canadian owned? All that kind of stuff is still kind of in play. On the regulatory side, yes, there's Bill C-27, which contains the Artificial Intelligence and Data Act. The bill was first tabled, we're coming up on 2 years ago now, in the summer of 2022, before ChatGPT, and that's important because the government is proposing a bunch of amendments to it now to take account of generative systems. What the bill at a high level requires is that companies that are developing, or I guess organizations that are developing or deploying so-called high-impact AI systems are required to meet a bunch of risk assessment, mitigation, and transparency measures. And what high impact means is now being defined or will be defined if the amendments are incorporated into the bill as things like, you know, the use of AI in health decisions by police forces, in employment decisions. And then there's a couple of like more contentious categories, including social media prioritization and moderation algorithms and the like. That bill is currently at clause by clause at the House Industry Committee, and at the pace that they are currently working through it, it will move back to Parliament in about 100 years.
I mean, is this a government? I mean, it makes me sound like such a Tory, but you know, there's all critics. Wow, the government is so slow and inefficient, and so on and so forth. I mean, there's a tension here because there's a need for the government to move with some haste. I mean, they can't sit around and wait forever. But on the other hand, there's also pressure to get it right because, you know, the regulatory regime is going to lock in a pathway. You know, you can amend it to some extent, but once you've set it, it becomes harder to do. You know, how is that tension between the need to get it done and the need to get it right playing out?
Yeah, if we zoom out a little bit, this is not just a tension playing out in Canada, right? The U.S. is dealing with this in a big way, so is the U.K., so is the Europe actually just passed its AI Act, which is one of the more, depending on which perspective you're coming from, more rigorous or more punitive sets of AI regulation we've seen. There's two kinds of tensions. One is a tension between sort of the way that this technology is advancing and putting in place rules that are set for a particular generation of this technology but don't adapt to what comes next. And that is an argument often put forward by people in sort of innovative industries in the technology and AI worlds to say, you know, certainly if the version of Bill C-27 that had been tabled in June 2022 was passed, it would, some of its provisions would probably have covered generative systems, but not, there would not have been some specific requirements around things like, for example, transparency, you know, making clear that when AI-generated content is AI-generated. There are some rules around that, for example, in the bill, or there would be, there will be if the amendments pass. So that's one tension. The other tension is, you know, certainly a lot of digital rights, folks that are active in the digital and human rights world are concerned that the way that these bills are written is inherently permissive of the technology in the sense that it's set, it accepts that the technology is going to be widespread and then tries to some extent preemptively, but mostly post hoc, deal with its potential negative impacts. And so, you know, there are concerns around things like collective rights. We have, in general, a legal system that's fairly based around individual rights, i.e. someone does something that hurts you, and you sue them, you file, you file a complaint against them, you take them to the human rights sort of tribunal system. But what AI could conceivably discriminate against whole groups of people. You may not know that you're being discriminated against. So there are tensions about how you incorporate these sort of new externalities of a technology that operates slightly differently than some stuff we've seen in the past into legislation that's written from a perspective that of the laws that we already have. I'm basically talking about the difficulty of writing laws in general, yeah. I think now.
Well, but I mean, it's relevant. I mean, it is such a potentially significant and already significant technology that this is where the fundamental challenges of politics become extraordinarily real and extraordinarily important. And I want to talk about another one of them, the effects that AI is having or will have on the job market and on labor more generally. So there's obviously concerns about suppressing labor power, about dampening incomes, even eliminating jobs or significant segments of industry. Earlier, you mentioned that, you know, lawyers might use AI to help prepare contracts. It used to be that, well, you know, the technology is coming for blue collar jobs. Now there's talk about it coming for white collar jobs, you know, reducing work that accountants do, that lawyers and law clerks do, and so forth. So we hear about productivity gains, quote unquote, but it also has a real effect on labor. So where are we now on these fronts, and where are we headed?
Yeah, that decision you make between blue-collar and white-collar labor is a really interesting one. A couple of years ago, my colleague Catherine McIntyre and I did this series of stories about the most automatable cities in Canada, based on some work a study that the finance department had put together that we got our hands on. And the town of Brooks, Alberta, ended up being the sort of most automatable city. And the reason is because they have these major meatpacking plants there. And the idea was that, you know, that kind of work could be automated by robotics. And now the most recent example that led to a little bit of buzz in the tech world was there's a company called Klarna, which does payment processing and buy now, pay later. And they eliminated 700 customer service jobs. Let me put that in human terms. They laid off 700 people before going public because they were able to automate those jobs. So that's a completely different kind of work, right? We were told for the longest time that it'll be the human touch and sort of knowledge work that will last. And now those are the jobs, in fact, where we are seeing job loss. There's a longer theory of automation that essentially automation does not lead to, it leads to job displacement and not job loss, in the sense that the work that you do will change and you may require different skills, but the same number of people in total, or in fact, even more people are employed in the long run. Of course, that's not much comfort to the people that are being displaced. So we are seeing in certain segments, and it's been most high profile in sort of knowledge and creative work. For example, the Actors Union during the Actors Strike in Hollywood, or the Writers Strike, trying to push for provisions in collective bargaining agreements that preserve what is not necessarily so much their right to labor, their right to work, as their right to their creative output. So writers saying, you know, you can't simply take everything I've ever written for a show, plug it into a thing and generate a new season of that show. Or actors saying, you can't scan me once or take my one performance and then use that to generate a new background character, a new extra in a TV show, just so that you don't have to have me show up on site and pay, you know, for my food and pay my per diem, that kind of thing. In sort of like more blue collar settings, there have been questions around automation at places like ports, right? Ports are a highly unionized environment where job allocation, shifts, all of that is set up in a system that goes back decades. If now the job of someone working on the ports is simply to oversee an automated crane system, maybe some of that breaks down. So we are seeing some of that. That stuff is much less, I would say, in legislation and regulation than some of the more consumer impact stuff.
I mean, at the risk of oversimplifying things, well, which is a hazard of the job, I mean, for years, there have been technological transformations that arrive that displace workers and even industries. You think about, you know, the decline of artisans, right, and the rise of later of mass production in the 20th and 20th century, and we completely transformed how we build and how we consume, and industries followed, and people found new jobs. You suggested as much earlier is that in the long run, this new productivity leads to new jobs and so on. But is there something about AI that is potentially different, whether or not it's a scale issue, that the scales, for instance, much more than other technological developments, or that the nature of it is such that it poses a greater threat to industries that we thought were protected. I mean, you mentioned actors and so on and so forth. I mean, I'm trying to think if there's a qualitative or quantitative difference between the AI transformation or the 20th century mass production transformation, or is this basically another iteration of a very old phenomenon?
Yeah, that is a really good question. I certainly have seen a lot of people who work in the AI world predicting that you'll have more one-person million-dollar businesses is often what people talk about, right?
Right.
So a person with an idea to sell some kind of widget, but as long as they can handle the production of that widget, everything else, sales, marketing, accounting, you don't need HR if you're a one-person business, I assume. But all of those other functions are then sort of passed off to an AI. So those are not job losses. They're jobs that never get created, in a sense. That is a conceivable outcome of a technology that can handle a lot of sort of admin stuff. I think there are people who would look at that as busy work that's getting automated. There's enjoyment and dignity in all kinds of work. And so, you know, I think is a value judgment rather than an efficiency or a productivity question. I don't think we've seen yet the evidence of it being some kind of step change. There's certainly plenty of predictions of that kind of thing. We have yet to see, for example, a company AI'd out of existence, right? Or a class of worker that no longer exists because of AI. A good example of this actually is a radiologist. So Jeff Hinton, who I referenced earlier, this University of Toronto prof, famously basically predicted the demise of the radiologist profession because some early attempts with image processing could identify cancers on scans better than a human could. So the idea was, like, if the AI can do it better, why would you ever use a human? Well, it turns out that getting your results, your cancer screening results from a computer is a little less comforting or bearable than getting them from a human. Also, it turns out that that technology doesn't necessarily actually work at scale as well as you would think. Because there are edge cases, right? And, you know, humans are pretty much designed for edge cases. So that is a sort of famous example of it not working. I think there are more radiologists working today than there were when he made the prediction. Now, does that mean the technology will never get that good? I mean, who can say? But for now, radiologists still have jobs.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a fascinating point, because there are things where it's sort of counterintuitive, where you think, oh, I don't want a machine doing that. And then someone says, no, I mean, you actually do want a machine doing that, because machines are more predictable, machines don't get tired, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I guess as AI develops, figuring out what those things are and aren't, it's going to be a bit of a process. Okay, in the last couple of minutes, I want to close out on the moonshot. You know, this comes up in the book in one chapter, kind of the moonshot promises of AI, or I should say potentialities, the social goods, right? The sort of quote-unquote technological solutionism promises, if we can be a little bit critical with it. The idea that AI can help solve the housing crisis, it can help solve the climate crisis, save species at risk, and so forth. I mean, how much stock do you or proponents of AI putting in these big social good leaps from AI?
I think there are certainly a lot of people who are legitimately working towards those goals. I'll give you an example. There's a team out of Google, part of which is centered in Montreal, which built this application using AI that can tell you on an individual level, can predict how much sunshine you're going to get in order to help you make a cost-benefit analysis of putting solar panels on your roof. And then they've actually scaled it up to city level. So, like, if a municipal government wants to figure out where the best place to put renewable energy generation might be, they can use this tool. And the reason that they did this is to try and incentivize people to get solar panels, because, you know, it takes away one uncertainty factor. That, I think it's probably fair to argue, contributes to solving the climate crisis. It doesn't solve the climate crisis, to be clear. It's a measure, right? It's a step. I think there are lots of steps being taken using artificial intelligence. There's a school of thought that says, you know, an artificial general intelligence that can process more information than a human ever could, that surpasses human intelligence, might come up with the silver bullet to the climate crisis. I am inherently skeptical of silver bullets, and therefore I'm inherently skeptical of a silver bullet of an AI that can come up with a silver bullet for one of our problems. But can specific AI applications built to solve specific problems help address some of these societal problems? Absolutely. I'll give you another example of this. There's a company called Signal One in Toronto where the AI was actually developed at St. Michael's Hospital. It's now been commercialized by this company. And what they do is better, basically, patient outcome prediction. So they give doctors and nurses an estimate of when a patient might be ready to be discharged, or when a patient might need to be monitored. The result is there, therefore, in theory, they've done some work to back this up, obviously, better outcomes for the patient who is monitored better, but also perhaps a better turnover in hospital beds that can then be used for someone else. Now, does that solution fix what word are we using these days? The cataclysmic state of healthcare in this country? No, but every extra bed is an extra bed, right? Mm-hmm. At the incremental level, certainly we're starting to see those applications. I think the sort of artificial general intelligence that will solve all of our problems, we're really good at creating problems.
You know what? I think that's the perfect note on which to end.
My nihilism wins out every time.
No, there's a lot of hopeful and encouraging bits in there. So I think it's just fair and balanced. That brings us to time. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's extraordinarily helpful. I'm just a little bit stunned at how much you were able to, how much detail and analysis you're able to pack into a small period of time. So I appreciate that very much. Thanks again for joining me.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
And as always, my thanks to Carolyn Smith, Ross Clark, and Aisha Jara, who make the show not just possible, but infinitely better than it would be without them. Thanks to them as well, and to you for listening. And we'll see you back here in 2 weeks.